I'm Courtney Romano, and you're listening to The Break Breakdown. All season long, we've been pulling back the curtain to share exactly how we produced our 7-episode series, Kinsley Versus, from start to finish. We've shared our budget, how we shot the one take in our final episode, the process of composing the soundtrack, and even details from release day. As of this recording, the series has had 10,000 views on YouTube, and we're continuing to gain traction. But even as we continue to promote Kinsley Versus, the producing team at Queensbird Films has our eyes on our next project, a feature film. We're currently in the development phase of the script. You can check out my personal TikTok account for some BTS of my writing process. I'll link that up in the show notes. And we have several other projects at nascent stages. But because making a feature film is the next step in our process, we want to learn from others who have done it successfully and repeatedly. Enter today's guest, filmmaker Noam Kroll. Noam is a director, cinematographer, a colorist, all positions he's held on multiple feature films, music videos, and advertising campaigns. He's the host of the hit podcast Show Don't Tell, a micro-budget filmmaking podcast about making quality work on a shoestring budget that I first started binging during post-production on my own short film. And he's the creator of The Backlot, a filmmaking community and feature film incubator. There's very little Noam hasn't done, but today we're going to focus our conversation on Disappearing Boy, the no-crew feature film he made over the course of a year, which is about to hit the festival circuit. After listening to him for years, I'm thrilled to say, Noam, welcome to The Break Breakdown.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here and excited to also go back and learn more about your project because that sounds so cool. But thanks so much for having me on.
I wanted to start with 5 quick questions up front, what we're calling the 5 up front. So these can be like quick, snappy answers as we're getting into it.
Perfect.
great. So did you go to film school?
I did not. I studied psychology.
I love that because I feel very often like as a filmmaker, I'm also a psychologist. Like
I think they go hand in hand. It kind of made sense at the time. And I still love thinking about the impact, even just in the story format. I often kind of wished I went to film school, but you know, I guess it's too late now.
Well, I would say it's never too late, but I would say that you've probably put yourself through like a master's and, you know, all the film school rigmarole in your career. So
it took me longer, but I got there one way or another. So, yes. But no film school for me, no traditional, I guess, film school.
When did you make your first film?
Well, it depends what you qualify. So if it's like my first short film that I actually like thought I made and finished and it was like, I thought it was good at the time was probably when I was like 20 and I was actually studying psychology. I started making these little short films and I made this one called Triggers and I acted in it and was kind of influenced by this movie called Palindrome. So I know these answers are short, so I won't go on a tangent, but I was 20, 21.
How many films have you made?
Oh, that's a good question. I actually don't even know the answer to it. So I've made 3 features now, like fully end to end. And I actually made another feature I never released. This summer I'm making like my 4th official feature. So I've made, 3 to 4 features. And then I've made, dozens of short films ranging from like little 1-minute movies to things I actually spent, some time on. But yeah, probably like, 50 to 75 projects, I guess, like personal projects.
That's amazing.
I mean, most of them are throwaway. Like, I mean, I'm including things where it was like, hey, call one friend and let's go walk down to the, beach and we'll shoot something for an afternoon and like that sort of stuff. So it sounds like more than it is, but probably like, 15 to 20 projects are a little more substantial.
I mean, that's film school right there. Okay. A little bit more fun. How do you take your coffee?
Oh, I take it as tea. I actually, going back to my university days, I would drink so much coffee, and I'm like super sensitive to caffeine. So I remember one day I drank like a venti Starbucks, whatever. And I was sitting in class and I was like, whoa, I feel like I'm like tripping out. Like this is too much. So now I'm a black tea guy. That's usually my drink.
And what did you wake up thinking about today?
I woke up the same as every day. I got to get my 3 morning pages done. The first thing I do when I wake up is write 3 longhand pages. I've done it for several years now. And it's always like, I don't feel right until I do that. And then in those, I was talking about everything I'm going to do today, including this interview, writing down, you know, I'm excited for this. I want to make sure I knock off certain things on my to-do list. And, you know, just recalibrating my brain for the day. So that's usually how I try to start.
That sounds so healthy. I should try that.
It helped me a lot. Like I started it out of necessity and now I'm hooked.
Yeah. I did the morning pages for a while, like in my early 20s. And I remember feeling just like mentally cleansed, like feeling like I've just like taken off any baggage and I can start the day on a blank page.
Exactly. And I try to remember something that Julia Cameron says in the book, which is on the days when you don't want to do them, it's usually the most important day. So whenever I'm like resisting doing it, I realize, okay, there's something I'm like avoiding or I'm not wanting to deal with. So I better like write this down. And sure enough, you get 2 pages in, and the thing like that you didn't think was bugging you kind of comes out. So I don't know. For me, it's, you know, some people have like meditation or whatever practice that they do that like gets them in the right headspace. And right now for me, this is helpful, but you know, things change. Yeah. Like maybe one day I'll find something else, but right now it's been great.
Okay. So I would love to get into the questions because I have so much to ask you. Our listeners, as you heard from the introduction, have been following us along as we've, been releasing we made a 7-episode digital series that I wrote and directed, and kind of breaking down the behind the scenes of that process. And what I've loved learning from you on your podcast and in your newsletter and your blog posts and everything is how you've created your kind of micro budget filmmaking world, the Gnome Kroll universe, if you will. but I think for our listeners who might not be familiar, can you give a quick definition of micro budget filmmaking?
Yeah. So to me, micro budget filmmaking has as much to do as with the budget as it does with the actual tactics in making the film. So like, you know, on a Hollywood level, an executive or something might use the word micro budget, but really they're referring to a film that is still made with like $1 million, because to them, you know, that's like nothing. To me, I usually qualify micro budget films as anything that's like $10,000, maybe to like $100,000. In that range. And then no budget films are the ones like even under 10,000, where it's just, you're just paying for lunch or gas or whatever. So like on a budget level, that's kind of how I define it. I know like SAG-AFTRA, for example, has a micro budget film agreement that stipulates your film has to be under $20,000. You know, there's some film festivals that say, you know, micro budget category, but it's under 500,000. So everyone defines it differently, which is why I always come back to like, well, how is it being made? Like, you know, there's certain qualities that most micro budget films have in common. Like they're usually either self-financed or crowdfunded, or, you know, they're bootstrapped. There's not some like big venture capital, like investment or something going into them, even no matter the cost of the production. And then, they're just done in like unconventional ways, where like a lot of the stuff I talk about, where like I made the last film, you know, essentially with no crew, and not that every film has to be made that way, but just using tactics that you couldn't otherwise use on a bigger production, hopefully actually making your film better or more unique as a result. So that's kind of how I define it.
Yeah, I feel like when I was thinking about it too, there's this kind of counterculture feel to it. It's like we want, you know, we've got like Marvel on one end, and then we've got the antithesis of that, which may or may not be financially antithetical, but it's definitely that kind of philosophy of what can we do with what we have around us.
Exactly. And that's for me, like so much of it to me is rooted in just my influences outside of filmmaking. Like I grew up just listening to, you know, like a huge music fan. I've played music like most of my life. And I always loved music, like whether it was like punk or, you know, hip hop or whatever the genre was. But like when there were people that were taking such limited means and then creating new styles and innovating with less, and then actually doing something that the people who had, you know, okay, let's, you know, pay $50 million for this studio album to be produced and these whatever, these super groups of famous artists. And then, you know, these people coming out of like a garage invent like grunge music or invent hip hop or whatever. And to me, that was always so inspiring. And I'm still to this day, like I look for ways to kind of approach filmmaking with that mentality. And I don't think that will ever change, even if I work with much larger budgets in the future. Like I always want that spirit to kind of be part of it.
It's the Rick Rubin Def Jam ethos.
Exactly. Yeah, I love it. Yeah, you've probably seen, I've been like nonstop. I'm such a fan of his new book. The Creative Act, which is like, I couldn't put it down when I read it. It was like, I want to reread it. It's so good.
I feel like his book and is kind of like the Tao Te Ching in a way of like, you can read each chapter. I felt like this with The War of Art too, Stephen Pressfield book. I don't know if you're familiar with that one.
I have it.
Yeah. It's in that Julia Cameron world too.
For sure.
Like you can read each chapter, and I've been trying to do that right now while I'm like on the third meaty pass of my feature script. I've been like trying to just like Rick Rubin my mind a little bit every day. Yeah. And it kind of has that meditative feel to it. What you're saying about like, you know, new forms and the counterculture and kind of like, you know, all of that inspiration in music. I love that idea as like a kind of ethos or ecosystem for micro budget filmmaking too. Look, I want to make a couple million dollar budgeted film for sure, but there is something kind of romantic about not being constrained by money. And I'm wondering, you know, was micro budget filmmaking for you, did that come as like a strategical kind of thing, or was it a necessity?
It was sort of just like instinct. It's just how I work is always like, I just start doing things without really like thinking that much about them. I just like to like try and fail and then learn and then try again. And I think like, you know, even when I was like a kid, I remember being like, you know, 10 years old and went to like Disney World in Florida. And then I came home and I was like, I grew up in Toronto and I'm like, okay, there's no Disney World nearby, but I like that experience so much. So like, how can I build? And I actually tried to like recreate Disney World, like in my house and invite my friends over and like have rides with them, like sitting in our laundry basket and like stuff like that. So like I don't know why, but like my wiring is always just like pulls me toward like just make whatever I'm interested in, just do the version of it that I can do right now, as opposed to like what the proper way is supposed to be or what the traditional path is supposed to be. And I totally am with you. Like I want to also work on bigger canvases. And like, I have one project right now in development that will probably take a year or two to get off the ground. But if it works out, it would be like significantly higher budget than what I've worked on. But I think that like, even if you have those aspirations, the start point for most of us is, or I think could be, or should be sometimes micro budget filmmaking, because, you know, by the time, like if I got, you know, $2 million for my first film, I wouldn't really know what to do with it. Whereas now I think I could be so efficient with it and I could stretch it so far. And I could understand that like there's different ways to make a movie. And there are people like Terrence Malick that get tens of millions of dollars to make movies, but still shoot them with natural light and with crews of like 10 people. And, you know, in all these like weird ways that to me are so exciting. So I think, you know, one way to innovate is by you restricting yourself to having a lower budget. But then as you grow as an artist and you do get more money, I think you can continue to carry that spirit forward and then just look for ways to continue to innovate and then just use the money that you have to amplify those unique things that you're doing. So yeah, I'm totally with you. And I think the only reason I bring that up is I think a lot of filmmakers feel like it's one or the other, but I really think we can do both. You know, you can do a long-term project that you're like pursuing and do something immediate that is within your means. And usually one will benefit the other.
Totally. It's such a great kind of holistic way to think about how we're like scaffolding our careers, kind of, you know, like, yes, let's have the long-term vision. Like I always say my career has been like a long con. Like I'm eventually just going to convince everyone to be, just let me do what I want to do. Yeah. Yeah. And like, I know what the punchline is like, I'm going to be able to do it, but like, I'm, you know, kind of working my way towards it. But it's, you're actually making me think of something that Daniel Kwan said about Everything Everywhere, where he said, I heard that I can either be the best or be the only. And I figured I'd never be the best, so why not be the only? And yep. It's coming up for me, I think, because I'm thinking about money. And like, that's kind of equated with like the best, right? We have the most money. We have the biggest budget. We have the a budget, you know, and investors and all this stuff behind us that like knows that we're going to knock it out of the park. We have the best cast, we, you know, all these things. And you can work towards that. But in the meantime, you can also work on your craft and work on your voice and your point of view, which is singular and authentic to you. And that's kind of the, be the only, you know, I can
exactly.
be the only.
I love that. I love that. I haven't heard him say that, but that is such a brilliant way to look at it. And I completely agree, because I think it's also important, like on that topic, to think about like, how do we define best? Because the easiest thing to measure is like money, because it's just a number. So we can say, all right, this person raised this much money, therefore, like they did a better job, or their film is better or has more legitimacy or whatever. But in reality, like if you're coming at it from an artistic standpoint, as opposed to strictly like a producerial, like business standpoint, then you understand, I think, that there's, you know, there's the money aspect, but there's all these other like more elusive qualities that can also help your film kind of rank in terms of like its value. And I feel, to me, two films that perform equally, let's say at the box office, one was made for no money with no stars, the other has money and has stars, I'm so much more impressed by the movie without the money, because they beat the odds. And to me, that's actually the bigger movie, because it's a bigger deal. Like Robert Rodriguez's like $7,000 movie he made, we're still talking about it like 31 years later or whatever, because it was so innovative. And all those other movies that premiered at Sundance with him that year, like 99% of them, like that had millions of dollars, like none of us are even talking about those, right? So I think it's, I think it's like how we think about movies and you know, how we measure the value that we see in our own films. I think it helps us if we can not tether that strictly to the budget. Because sometimes the people that get the budgets aren't necessarily the most talented or the best filmmakers. They just know someone with either the deepest pockets, or they're particularly savvy at like negotiating investments with people. But, you know, does that make it a better film is always the question. And I would rather fail trying to do something kind of on a low budget than fail with like millions of dollars on the line. So, you know. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but that's usually kind of where I'm coming from.
I feel like I'm just a quote machine right now, so everybody forgive me. But I do remember Charlie Day also talking about like if his dad telling him, if you're going to fail, you're going to fail. So if you're going to fail, fail at the thing you love, you know? So
exactly.
It's like that kind of mentality. Okay, I want to talk about Disappearing Boy.
Sure.
It's so fascinating to me. And I just, to say to all of our listeners, go back and listen to episode 200 of Show Don't Tell, which is where I think you, first of all, congrats on 200 episodes.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. And I guess, yeah, you heard it. So, because I talk about just like some lessons learned. It was really a blog post I wrote about the movie, and then I published it on the podcast. But
yeah
I'll let you jump in.
Well, you have, I was just going to say, you have so many great kind of technical points that you leave us with of, you know, do's and don'ts kind of a thing on a technical level. So I want people to go listen to that. And then I want to talk a little bit technical, but I also want to talk a little bit about your philosophy in actually setting up the film, it's the production itself.
Sure.
So I come from an acting background, and I had a teacher in college who said to me, Courtney, she had a fake accent. She said, Courtney, you're not Cicely Berry yet. You're going to have to act from the inside out. And what she meant by that was like, I had done something dramatic, like I fell to the floor or something, right? I was trying to use my outside in acting, right? So I was doing things on the outside to make a feeling come up. And what she was saying at the time was, no, you need to start with the feeling and then the outside will reveal itself to you.
Yes.
And so I was thinking about that with how you did Disappearing Boy. And because for me, it looks like maybe you worked outside in and gave yourself parameters and then found the story. But I'm not sure if that's true. So I was wondering, did you have the narrative concept before you started? Or how did that work with the technical structures and parameters you put around the production process?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because I think in my case, it was a little bit of both. Like there was some outside in terms of like, okay, what are my constraints? What do I have to work with? But there was also this like very internal thing in terms of like the subject matter and the way I wanted to tell the story. So I hadn't really thought of it till now, but I think at the time when I started, so like to go back a little bit, I was trying to make this other feature and I was actually like really not like I had probably one of the biggest failures or setbacks in my career right before I shot this movie, which was I spent like a year writing a script, cast this movie. I actually had investors for the first time, had producers, like was sort of scaling things up. And then we had this kind of force majeure situation where we lost a location, and it was our main location at the very last minute, like right as we were about to like shoot. And then everything sort of like fell apart and I had to decide, am I going to just pick up the pieces, you know, shoot the same movie like next month and maybe recast some roles, or like, what should I do? And I just felt like at the time, like I've never made a film by myself. And not that I want to make every film that way, but I always kind of wanted to try it, because going back to like, don't be the best, be the only, I was thinking about like, look, like every filmmaker has their thing. Like Tarantino has his like dialogue, or, you know, whoever, like they all have their style, their thing. Like Spielberg does like the blockbuster, like PG-13 thing, like brilliantly. And like, you know, what's my thing? And I don't know what it is really, but I think that one of the components of it is that I enjoy doing everything. So even though there's these directors that have accomplished so much more and that I admire so much and who I wouldn't even like remotely compare myself to, but I know one of the things that like maybe they wouldn't do or couldn't do is to like go and actually by themselves make a movie. And I thought, okay, if that's something I could do that probably like some of my filmmaking heroes might not even be able to do. Again, I'm not saying I'm going to make a better movie than them, but it's a different type of workflow and experience. And it's probably something that I could do. So it came from that place of like, why am I, you know, when I'm trying to scale things up and go against my nature, I'm resulting in this project that ends up sort of crumbling down. And the sort of opposite of that is to lean into what makes me unique and what I think I'm good at, and you know, pushing away the things that I'm not as good at or that I'm not as naturally inclined to do, like fundraising, and just say like, yeah, what do I do right now? Like, how do I make another movie in the same time frame? And like, I convinced myself that a year from that point, I was going to have a finished feature film. Like, it wouldn't be the movie I'd been writing for a year. It would be a different movie, and whatever happened, happened. But like a year from then, I would have a finished movie. And that's what happened. I basically just wrote a treatment. I had an idea kind of kicking around for a while. But I had my first son. Now he's four, almost four. But at the time he was like, you know, 2.5 or something. And I was like feeling this weird emotion, like that I'm sure you very much would understand, when you have a kid, is like your brain just changes. And like all of a sudden, like every night when I would go to sleep, like I was just like thinking of like all the horrible things that could happen and like the anxieties. And I wanted to channel that energy into something creative, because I'm like, this is like a crazy emotional experience that I'm going through. And I sort of took that energy, and I took the fact that, okay, I have my kid who's like, I think is very, everyone thinks their kid is cute, but I think he's really cute. And he likes when I film him, he likes working on things with me. And I thought like, you know, he's only going to be this age once. Most films can't use kids on an indie level because they're so expensive and hard to work with. So why don't I bookend the film with some scenes with him in it? I'll make it like a kidnapping thriller because that taps into this like weird, you know, kind of parental feeling of danger that I have now. And I'll do it in a way that taps into like the way I think I can best tell a unique story now, which is to do it myself, do it on the smallest budget possible. And even though I could have, you know, put some more money into it and actually either raised money or put my own like savings or whatever into it, I just said, no, like, I'm also going to use this as an example for other filmmakers of how even if you don't have a dollar, you can make a movie. Like you can pick up your camera or your phone and get a friend. And like I ended up spending $6,000 on the movie, but only because I paid the actors like the regular rate like they would get if it was a regular SAG production. And, you know, for someone else who's like 22 years old and they just have friends that want to do it for fun, like they could do what I did for free. So I mean, so the origin of the film was very much a culmination of like where I was at in the moment, like emotionally, just strategically, because I wanted to get, you know, keep the train moving, get another movie off the ground. But then also just from like the educational side of it, of like always, like whenever I make a film, I always think I want to try to do something completely different than I've done before and then share whatever I learned with as many other filmmakers as I can. And this just seemed to be kind of at the intersection of all of those goals.
I feel like that is such a helpful thing for other filmmakers and indie artists to hear, is just like leaning into what is. So yeah, there's so much outside of our control, especially when you're trying to get investments and, or even you like do the whole film and then you send it to the box office and don't know what's going to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's so much outside of your control, but this sounds like something where you're like, okay, I'm going to lean into the parts where I do have control and see what I can make out of that. And also it took a year to film. So $6,000, even though if I were 22, I'd be like $6,000, where am I going to get that? But if you take that over the course of a year, it's like, oh, that's actually doable for a lot of people.
Well, that was the biggest benefit of like scheduling it the way that we did, which just for like the listeners to have context. So basically like we would film, I wrote the treatment, then I wrote the first act in full, but I didn't write anything beyond that. We shot the first act over the, like, so I did like the opening scene, which we, I thought I was going to reshoot, but we didn't, but that was like the first day. And like, just as an, like an aside, like literally from the beginning, it went off the rails because like I wanted to shoot at the beach and my son was supposed to be in the opening and we went to the beach and it was like the one day in Malibu when like the weather was like windier than I've ever felt in my life. And there was like sand in everyone's eyes. And we're like, okay, what do we do now? And then we're like, okay, we'll go like drive up the mountain and find like a hiking trail. And we rewrote the scene. And I realized like in that moment, that was going to be the whole movie, was going to be like doing it that way and basically just documenting and collaborating. Like, yeah, I'm all over the place, but to go back to Rick Rubin, you know, he talks about like being collaborative, not just with people, but with the elements, like with the universe, with nature. And that's sort of like, you know, the book wasn't out at that time, but I sort of felt that instinctively too, because I was like, yeah, this is it. Like I looked at the footage at the end of the day. I'm like, this is better than what it would have been at the beach because we worked with what we had. We didn't say like, oh, screw it, we'll come back tomorrow. We found a more unique way.
And I was actually going to ask about the schedule because it was it was over a year. And, you know, I'm a mom. I also have a 4-year-old and a 3-month-old.
Same age as mine, basically. Yeah. Almost exactly.
Do you have 2 kids?
My second is turning 3 months at the end of the month. So
Oh my gosh. Yeah. There you go. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're in the same chaotic boat.
Yeah. It's a pocket. It's definitely a pocket. And it's like, you know, like a lot of being gentle with myself and being like, it's okay. Like not everything happens right now. And what was kind of appealing to me about talking about filming this over a year is thinking about the public school schedule for my daughter and thinking about like oh, I know when the dates off are. I could actually plan a film around like our life. Like,
yeah.
I work a full-time job. I have two kids. I have, you know, just like dealing with life as a human being is, you know, work enough. So I'm wondering, did you set the schedule at the beginning of the year, or did that also kind of unfold?
Yes. And thank you. Cause that's sort of, I guess where I left off was I was going to give context on the schedule. So we did the first day, which was that like crazy Malibu day. And then like we shot another 2 days, which those were the only days that were scheduled. It was like the first day. And when I say scheduled, I mean like sending a text message to my friend Josh, who was acted in one of my other films, and just saying like, hey, like maybe next weekend we'll like shoot the next scene. Like it was that casual. And then, so we filmed the first scene, but then we filmed the next like scene or two, which ended up being like the first act in full. We shot probably like within a month of starting. And then from then on, basically the plan was I would have like a window of time where we might do the next shooting block, but I knew I would take like anywhere from like a month. I thought it would take a month off in between. I ended up taking sometimes 2 months off, but the plan was like take a month off, look at the footage, edit it, which I didn't edit nearly as much as I thought I would, but it was still helpful to look at it. And then, you know, write the next scenes. And I kind of knew where the story would go, but because we were shooting sequentially, I could change things as we went. Like if, again, like the beach, we ended up at this other location, and then that connected later on. Like it won't make sense now because people haven't seen the movie, but like it actually helped us inform some like later decisions. So over the course of the year, it was very much like, you know, we only knew when the next shoot date would be. And even then, sometimes like it was just a vague like month long window, and it sometime in May we'll shoot another 3 days. And then, yeah, once it felt like the script was there, we shot more. And then by the end of the year, like by September, the film was basically fully shot. And I kind of sped it up as we went. So like the first act, it was like 1 day and then 2 days, and it felt really slow. But by the end, we shot like 5 days in the last month or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it very much like ramped up when we got in the rhythm. And then I, you know, from like September to December, I basically like edited the movie, almost finished it. And then, you know, early into this year, I just kind of like, you know, color and sound and just all the finishing touches, basically. A big part of it for me was to make it more sustainable as well. And like I said, like, fortunately, like if I wanted to do it, like financially, like back to back, I could have found a way to do that. But it was more about like, if I'm doing everything myself, I have to plan all of this. And I just don't have the time now with like, you know, life and kids and all this stuff. Like, I'm not going to be able to like plan a back to back 15-day shoot or something. But what I can do is like have a month off in between shoot days or 2 months off to figure out what to do, because then it's only a few minutes a day. And like, and for anyone listening to this, like, I genuinely believe that at this point, if I had 1 hour a week, I could make a feature film. I think anyone could. Like, I don't think you need as much time as we all think. I think it's just like how we use the time and how we schedule it and the way we approach it. Like, you can do so much over a course of a year if you break it into these little bite-sized chunks. So you could break it even smaller than I did, you know, and right. I would consider doing that. Like, I have ideas where like I could spend 15 minutes a day like shooting something, and then that becomes a movie. Like, I love those sort of models.
Yeah. So for someone like me, so I come from more of a, like from a narrative director angle than from like the technical director angle. Mm-hmm. And a no crew feature, you know, what hasn't actually been said is that like, it's no crew, but yes, it is. It's you as the crew. So you're director, you're DP, you're gaffer, you are, you know, sound op, you're all of these different technical aspects. If someone's coming from that more narrative space, is this an option that's available to them? And if you think that it is, you know, what are kind of the first steps of learning or maybe even mastery that someone would need to know to be able to execute what you did?
Another great question. So I think Well, first of all, I think there's a lot of ways to do something like this that isn't always identical. So let's say somebody really didn't want to hold the camera themselves. Like, you might be able to do it as a two-person crew. So it's like you, and then you have someone who's kind of like a technical jack of all trades who can roll sound and camera. So like there's that, but I think for anyone that does want to do it themselves, like I would very much stress that there sometimes like not knowing is an advantage too, because you can break the rules and do things like, let's say, an acclaimed like DP that wants to direct their first feature, like they're never going to want to do it like this because they're like, no, I'm a DP, has to look a certain way. I need my AC, I need my gaffer, my grip. But if you don't have that background, you actually have a bit of an advantage because you can shoot something on whether it's your iPhone or mirrorless camera, like I did, something like kind of more bare bones and scrappy, and you're not going to see all the problems with that. You might see more of the benefits. There's definitely still a steep learning curve, like rolling sound and camera, just learning that, let alone balancing them both while you're trying to direct. Like there's no question, like that is hard. But I think like, yeah, a few things I would say. First of all, what I did and what I think everyone probably should do is just simplify it as much as possible. So like on my film, immediately I said, okay, no, there's no lights, even though like I can kind of light decently if I want to, like it's all natural light or available light. And what we get is we're going to work with the elements. So like that eliminated so many questions and issues right off the bat. For like microphones, like, you know, using these Rode microphones that are completely foolproof, where like you just push one on, push the other one on, and they just work. So like I literally, like the extent of it, like it, I technically I'm doing all the roles, but really I simplified the roles so much that like it was like, okay, let's sit down for breakfast. It's the beginning of the day. We're going to talk through the scene. At the end of that, I'm going to fold these little like triangles out of gaff tape, tape the mics to my actors' chests, plug them into like this literal Zoom recorder here, hit record, and that's it. And I would just let it run and let them talk. And like it was a little difficult to sync up, but I figured out how to sync it up later. And I basically just rolled and yeah, like I am a bit more technically inclined. So I did take it like beyond that sometimes in terms of like getting additional sound effects or like doing some like, you know, whatever camera tricks and things like that. But I think that like my advice for someone would be, yeah, A, keep it simple. B, don't worry about gear that in any other way other than the gear that's going to make your life easy. So if that means like Filmic Pro on the iPhone, I at one point was going to shoot this on the iPhone. I think like that's totally acceptable, or whatever other camera that you find easiest. Same goes for sound. Like find a way to make it easy and know that like you don't need a lot of gear or a lot of complexity to make it look and sound good, even though like the experts in the field will tell you that you do. And they're not wrong, but they're also not making these kind of movies. So they actually don't know what's right for these kind of movies. So I would say that. And I'd also say like, start slow because, you know, your first shoot day could be a scene that is like, you know, a 15 second scene of the movie that you could shoot in an hour. So I would go in slow, either do some test shoots or just break it down into such small chunks that it's totally okay if it, the first day, like you look at it and you're like, no, this footage is terrible. Go back the next day. I've done that, you know, not on this movie, but I've had other movies where like I lit myself and it's like, oh, this was supposed to be night and my lighting is terrible. Let's go back tomorrow. Now I know how to fix it. And you learn so much that way. So yeah, so I think it's not that it's easy, but I think it's doable if you come at it from the angle of like, how can you do it as opposed to like, how is it supposed to be done?
You know, as filmmakers and any kind of independent artist, I feel like the projects that we're working on, we have to kind of balance the craft benefit versus the career benefit, meaning we definitely are wanting to learn craft and understand that, but we're also definitely wanting to like sustain our careers and hopefully get to a point where, you know, we can like quit our day job or, you know, make this connection or whatever like the goal is for our careers in that moment. And I totally see how doing a no crew feature film would be a massive craft benefit. I mean, massive, just in terms of what you're talking about, like teaching yourself on the fly, working with what you've got, innovating the whole, you know, like punk rock filmmaking, essentially, right?
I love it.
Rebrand. But do you see, and I guess, what would you advise a kind of this specifically no crew feature film? How would you advise working that in the career benefit silo?
I love all these. Honestly, I don't think anyone's asked me like any of these questions. So this is so good. And it's making me think of like blog posts I should do. There's a couple sides of it. And I think first off, I will say, if you want to make a big film, the best way to get there or whatever it is, like, so if making a big film, you know, people might equate with like more financial stability and this and that, which I'll talk about separately. But let's say like that is what someone believes. The best way to make a big film is to make a small film first, because if you look at like pretty much like any director we love, any director we admire, unless it was like a pure sort of nepotism thing, or they just had, you know, access to millions of dollars, they all worked for years and years and years in other areas and then scaled up, whether it was like micro budget features, like, yeah, like you go back to like Scorsese's first film, Chris Nolan, whoever you want to say that you love, and they all like made things with nothing. So like that is kind of the starting point for everybody, not necessarily a no crew feature, but some sort of like DIY path. But the other thing I'd say is that if you look at the most successful people in the film industry, it's very, very rare that any of their income primarily actually comes from making movies. Even again, like some of these directors who we love so much, if you actually could see behind the curtain, what they're making their money from is like they've invested in real estate, they own a restaurant, they've partnered with like some film school, and there's this guy I always talk about, amazing filmmaker Hong Sang-soo, who makes these like incredible movies, and he self-finances all of them, and they go to Berlin and Cannes. He's like an internationally acclaimed filmmaker, but he's a professor too, you know? So I think that the thing that I wish I knew earlier that I finally get is that like, there is no moment where anyone really breaks in or just has it made, unless it's like a complete fluke and your first movie is like Avatar and you just live off the residuals forever. Like for most people, even that have like big movies in Sundance, in theaters, like Netflix, you name it, like, that is not their primary source of income. So I also know like personally a lot of filmmakers and producers that have made movies that like, I won't say by name, but that have made sometimes like in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and they've made next to nothing from them. So like, I think just the nature of the business is that like, I always see it as like the films are a big part of your brand as a filmmaker and as a part of like your creativity, but they can lead to other things that are actually more lucrative in terms of just strictly financial. And that's sort of like, at least what I've tried to do too, is like, I hope my films make lots of money like anyone else, but like if they don't, that's okay, because I have a production company, I have other businesses online. And I think that to me, like that's the way to think of it for filmmakers is like, you know, let's say you're making your $10 million movie and you're satisfying that part of your creativity, but let's say you're still not able to like pay the bills, even though you're making those big movies, which is very common, then like, what would you want to be doing in that case? Like, what would you want that other thing to be? Would it be a business? Would it be consulting? Would it be teaching? Whatever it is. And then try to do the mini version of that now, you know, and then you can scale it up over time. And then if you get lucky and you do have an avatar, then you could go retire in, you know, Hawaii or do whatever you want. But if you're like everyone else, like, you know, look at like Francis Ford Coppola and like, you know, there's a reason like he has a winery, right? Or like there's a reason like all of these people have like production businesses or commercial, like they direct commercials in between movies, right? So I think to me, it's all about like the body of work. It gives you a strong foundation to kind of launch from on your own terms. But I think it's always up to us to decide how we want to kind of capitalize on the things that have worked for us. Because I don't think there's ever a point, like I just know so many filmmakers that are so far ahead of me and that have had so much more success than I've ever had. And like, none of them find it easy. So I'm like, okay, if they're not finding it easy, like I better figure out how to have some other source of income or something right now, you know?
Yeah. I think that's such a, great answer to hear, especially for our audience, because I think everyone's looking for that magic bullet. And the truth is, like, do you want a long career in filmmaking? And if you do, like, what's the reality of making that happen? You know,
exactly.
And I think, you know, you and I are the same age. And when we were graduating from college, I think in my mind, I was like, oh, I'm a failure if I have a day job. And what has transpired in life is like, wow, that's indoctrination of like capitalism, but also like okay, let me get that like internal thing out of me, because that doesn't make any sense and that's not true. And also, you know, there's definitely something to say about being able to pay your bills and all of that, and I'm not putting that aside, but there's also something to say to say I have a body of work. Everyone knows my point of view from the body of work. I have an expression, and that is, you can't put a price on that.
Yeah. And really, like, a lot of my favorite artists and filmmakers and people and music or whatever, like, they've done different things brilliant. Like, so Tom Ford, who's like, I think like a brilliant director, but like, who knew, like, he's also like a brilliant like fashion designer that has this like incredible brand, and then and whatever he wants now, he can just go make a movie, and they're probably better movies because he doesn't have to do them for the money. He doesn't have to just do some script he doesn't like so Netflix will pay his mortgage that month. It's like, no, he has his own thing. Or like, you know, musicians, like you know, I just look at like the, like Jay-Z or people like that, that like start their own record labels and are like equally brilliant in business as they are in creativity. And that kind of stuff inspires me more personally than a filmmaker that just kind of got lucky, sold their movie. Like, just like there's like on the business side, like there's some entrepreneurs that like have like done really well with like financially, like they've sold their companies for like billions of dollars or whatever. But like, I'm not necessarily inspired by all of them, because some of them got lucky. Like, some of them just like were at the right place at the right time. And it's the people that like, again, like defied the odds, figured out a way to do it on their terms and make it work. And like, I love that like Tom Ford can one day be like directing a movie and the next day be like, you know, designing like fashion and all of that. And that's how I feel. Like, I don't want to feel like, cause just like you're saying, like having a day job, I had that in my head too, but like it was so silly. And because now, like, you know, even though I work for myself, I still really have a day job. I might be my own boss, but like, I have to keep my production company going. Like I work, I'm my own employee. So it's not like I don't have my own version of a day job. And I think like there's no version of it that's ever going to be like perfect for anybody, you know? So it's like, I think we just have to kind of accept like, okay, what are we best at? How do we want to be spending our time? And like, what do we want to do in between movies? Because even if we have all the money in the world, like, especially if we have more money, you're not making movies like necessarily every year. So what are you doing on those years off? And, you know, outside of money, like, how are you spending your time? So yeah, I think, you know, it's just how not to say it's like the right way to look at it at all, but like, it's just the only way that to me kind of makes sense is to, yeah, think of it like holistically in terms of like, and realistically in terms of like, you know, we base our, so often I think like we base our like projections of the future, hopes for the future, based on realities that don't actually exist, because we think it's easier for other film. I know I do that. Like, can't speak for you, but like, I know when I was younger, especially, I would just assume like, oh, this person's like, this actor is like famous. I know who they are. So they're the wealthiest person, or they have all the, and it's then, you know, you realize as you get older, like none of those assumptions were ever true. So to base your strategy on something that is actually a guess and is an inaccurate guess usually about someone else's success, because you don't see all the real thing, you know, like what's actually going on under the hood. You know, I think that that can lead you down a path where you're chasing someone else's dream and goal, and it actually doesn't necessarily benefit your own.
I'm glad that I heard that one today, because I really heard that one today.
I need to remind myself of it too, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. We always do. And it's like, it's not like we get it and then we keep it. It's like we get it and we have to keep reinforcing it. And yeah, it's part of the craft, right?
100%.
This has been awesome. Where can people watch Disappearing Boy? I think it's heading to festival right now.
Yeah. So I can't say where quite yet. There's a few festivals we're looking at doing a premiere at. And then eventually we'll do probably a very small theatrical thing and then release it online. So if people want to follow along, they can. The best place is my newsletter. I try to share everything on there. So it's just noamkroll.com/newsletter. And then that also like connects to my blog, noamkroll.com, and then my, you know, Instagram, Twitter, all that's on there. So people can follow along if they're interested. And yeah, I just try to send like, you know, filmmaking tips or anything that like I'm learning or discovering that I think it would be valuable. I try to email people once a week, and yeah, and that's been fun. So, you know, hopefully I'll connect with some of your audience and would love to, you know, turn the tables and one day when you're ready, have you on a show, don't tell, and we'll do, we'll do a reverse interview.
Oh my gosh. I would love that so much. And yes, and I can say the newsletter is great. I always read it, which I can't say about all the newsletters I subscribe to.
I appreciate
and,
it.
And I will definitely put all of that in the show notes. And just thank you so much for your time. I'm really excited to share this conversation with people.
Amazing.
Thanks for listening to today's bonus episode of The Break Breakdown. If you haven't already, sign up for the Queensbird List. It's a weekly digest curated for curious, creative, ambitious minds making indie art. Today's episode was hosted by me, Courtney Romano, and executive produced by Benjamin Shaw. Noam Kroll was our guest. For more information on Noam's work, visit noamkroll.com and find him on social at Noam Kroll. Season 3 of The Break Breakdown was made possible through the generous support of Eddie and Wendy Shaw. Special thanks to Craig and Elle and Ren Hansen. You can watch Kinsley Versus on YouTube, and The Break Breakdown is a project of Queensbird Films.